Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions that you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos. And this week I want to wish everybody a happy 4th of July, this great weekend of celebrating our Independence Day. And I've got R2-D2 here, wishing the happy 4th for everybody. And in case you're a Star Wars nerd, I do know that this is actually for May 4th, which is Star Wars Day. May the 4th be with you. But I absconded with this image for celebration for today. So there you go. And also, I thought it might be appropriate, given that this is a critical thinking channel, and something that I like to promote is knowledge and learning, that I found a quote from one of our founding fathers, Benjamin Rush, applicable to this. And it is, says here, "Freedom can exist only in the society of knowledge. Without learning, men are incapable of knowing their rights. And where learning is confined to a few people, liberty can be neither equal nor universal." Benjamin Rush was a rather liberal member of the founding fathers. And also, ironically, Scientology has nailed him down as a very evil man because they consider him the founder of psychiatry. And so therefore, he must be bad. So anyway, kind of ironic that I'm reading a quote about liberty and knowledge from Benjamin Rush today. So let's get on with your questions. Here we go. MBAO 21. During 2008-2010, anonymous protesters were relatively frequent and popular worldwide. Would you describe what it was like being in the church during this movement? Have you picketed Scientology churches since leaving? I was out and about going from org to org doing Sea Org recruitment and then working on ideal orgs during that time. And it was a pain in the ass having anonymous protesters around because we had to shut down operations and keep things, you know, always, you know, avoiding them and not looking at them and pretending to ignore them. And you know, sometimes they'd be making a lot of noise with boom boxes out there and dancing around and whatnot, especially in Minnesota. In Twin Cities, they were really a presence. And frankly, I just hated them. I just didn't like them. I don't feel that way now. But at the time, they were just a big pain in the ass to me. And the music and whatnot, by the way, would really disrupt our operations because in the Scientology churches, they want things to be quiet for the auditing to happen. And they around the auditing rooms, you know, it's not supposed to be a lot of noise. You can get a lot of trouble for making a lot of noise. And in the Minnesota church at the time, the auditing rooms were right on the level with the street. So the boom boxes and all the music out there were preventing anything and any auditing from happening. And I doubt that the protesters knew that, but, you know, good on you for making that happen. So that's what I kind of thought about that. And no, I've not ever protested in front of a church since I left. Protesting like that's not really my style. I don't, you know, I'm not down on it. I don't think it's a useless activity. Just because when I was in, I wasn't paying attention to the protesters, but that doesn't mean other people haven't. There are certainly stories where they have. So I think it's a good thing to be doing, but it's not something I've done. Matt Kordelski. You have talked about the abuse of power in Scientology. Most of the other documentaries and webcasts about Scientology and any cult/mind control organization talk a lot about the abuse of power, the kind of abuse that pops up all the time in any organization where someone has power over someone else, the kind we hear about in sports programs, the military, corporate boardrooms, summer camps, high schools, colleges. Sexual harassment. Ex-members talk about all the horrible, degrading things L. Ron Hubbard, David Miscavige, and or their lieutenants manipulated and pressured them into doing. But none of them ever say what I kept expecting them to say. They never bring up anyone trying anything sexual on them. Has this happened in Scientology? Well, the short answer is, yeah, of course it's happened in Scientology. You don't have a group of people, thousands large, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands large, over 60 years without there being some, you know, problems with sexual harassment or with, the biggest problem I saw and experienced when I was in the Sea Org was statutory rape. And by experienced, I don't mean that I took part in anything like that. I mean that I observed that it had happened, and it was always handled internally. It was always hushed up. It was always shut down. You know, records of these kinds of illegal activities going on in the church are kept on the DL or destroyed, so that there is no written record of it. But there were cases of this going on. Yeah, absolutely, where you know, adults would take advantage of you know, pre-adult children. And I don't mean like 10-year-olds. I mean, you know, 16, 17, 18-year-olds. But it did happen, and there's no excuse for it. And I don't mean to, by putting those ages on it, I'm just describing what occurred. I'm not excusing it. So that kind of thing I did see occur. I saw it happen a handful of times, though. In 27 years, only a handful of instances of that. And the reason for it, and I really want to stress this, is because in Scientology, sexual conduct and sexual activity is a very repressed and controlled activity. They control their members through controlling their sexual behavior, their sexual lives, their sexual deviancy, their sexual attitudes. And the church has a very Leave It to Beaver 1950s conservative attitude about sex, which comes right out of Hubbard's works. So that's why they're so homophobic. That's why they're very down on sex, and they consider it just, you know, sort of a thing that people do, you know. And this is especially true at the Sea Org level, where it's, you know, it's just every part of your life is completely regulated and controlled, and that very much includes your sex life. So this kind of thing is monitored and watched pretty closely. And generally speaking, when you have that level of control, practically an Orwellian 1984 level of control over people's lives, they tend to try to keep their noses clean, you know, and you don't get a lot of debauchery or, you know, there's no sex orgies or anything like that going on. And also, I just never heard of any instances of sexual harassment as such. Maybe another thing I can say about that is that in the C organization, certainly, and definitely out in the other orgs, a lot of the seniors are women. There's a lot of women in senior positions in the church. You have David Miscavige as the head, but he really likes to put women below him, and at lower echelons, it's kind of a coin toss as to whether it's going to be men or women. Scientology is not an old men's club. So I believe, I'm going out on a limb here because I don't know, but I'm thinking that that the instances of sexual harassment of women to men is lower, less than it would be, you know, the other way around. So maybe that's a factor as well, but, you know, that's just conjecture on my part. KT, I've seen this pattern that the Church of Scientology has with overwork, tiredness, a false veneer, separation from children, etc., throughout other harmful groups, even in mainstream society. Do you notice these similarities? Also, it seems to me that generally people in the Church of Scientology put on a happy facade, and that in a way they're not allowed to express freely what they feel. Could you please share in your opinion what the general culture in Scientology was like? Well, here's the thing in Scientology. It's a very public image conscious group. And the other thing is that, here's where I think this comes from. Within the world of Scientology, everything that L. Ron Hubbard ever said or wrote is flawless and perfect and immaculate. And it always is supposed to work all the time on everybody. And as I've mentioned in videos in the past, if it doesn't work on you, it means that you're a criminal or a suppressive person, or that there's something wrong with you and that you've done something wrong. So nobody in Scientology doesn't want it to work on them. They don't want to be perceived as a problem case or somebody that you know, that the tech doesn't work on. And because they might be singled out as, you know, it's very interiorizing. The attention goes inward to you if it's not working, right? What did you do wrong? What's the problem with you? Not what the problem is with the tech. So, you know, that could be one reason why people aren't so anxious to, you know, blab, blab, blab and bitch and moan and complain. The other thing is that, you know, it's just the culture in Scientology that everybody's happy all the time. And another factor or reason for that is because anger, hate, fear, grief, apathy, these, you know, these negative kind of emotions in the Scientology world, they're considered negative emotions, are called misemotion. You know, they're actually the label for that. There's positive or free or, you know, plus emotion, and then there's minus emotion. on that scale that they've put together of emotions. And you're not supposed to be hanging around in those minus emotions. That's something people will look down on you for. Oh, he's being misemotional. You know, oh, he was being griefy, you know. Like that's something that's not really acceptable in the Scientology world. And so you grow to repress and suppress those feelings in yourself. And that is where a lot of psychological damage comes in to Scientology, is in a person learning to repress their own feelings and emotions and reactions to things, and always putting a smiley face on. Things are great. Like Jason Begay talked about in the Going Clear documentary. BG6B7BFT. Not even going to try to figure out what that means. There are a couple of different definitions for atheism floating around right now, and some self-identified atheists can get pretty butthurt if you try to use a definition other than their favorite. I can totally appreciate your desire to not step in the middle of that. I'm not really happy with your use of the word knowledge, though. The implication that you must have absolute certainty in order to claim knowledge doesn't really fly with my understanding of skepticism slash rationality. To a skeptic, certainty is practically a swear word, isn't it? I haven't been totally clear about why it is that I'm even stepping into this area or talking about it. And it's not because I'm into epistemology, which is the study of knowledge. That's a philosophical discipline I know almost nothing about, and I don't really want to get into. The whole point of my channel is to kind of follow my own journey with critical thinking, and I'm passing information and knowledge along as best I can, sometimes as I'm learning it or developing it. So this is, I'm not coming at this from the point of view that I have established, you know, ultimate truths or something like that. And I hope I never get to that position where I'm trying to talk down to people or something like that. I'm talking about the differences between belief and knowledge, or facts, for a reason. And the reason I'm talking about those things is because I'm trying to create the idea of tolerance. And I think that a lot of intolerance in this world comes from the misunderstanding of what a belief is versus what knowledge or evidence or facts are. And I know that, you know, there's very little certainty in this world. I know that there's very little we can be 100% certain of. You know, somebody, a week ago was telling me, you know, well, prove your, you know, what your name is. Prove your name. And I'm like, okay, you know, I got nothing to say to that. Like, how am I going to do that? I don't know, right? But what I do know is that when you have a group or you have an individual over here who is, you know, a Bible thumper and telling other people that they are lesser people or lesser beings or are undeserving or are going to suffer, hellish damnation, and not only telling them that, but actually executing violence and, you know, hateful actions and marginalizing that other group of unbelievers because they don't believe the same thing this person believes, that is intolerance. That's the kind of intolerance I'm talking about. And unfortunately, I've seen that same kind of intolerance from the other side too, which is kind of what got me into talking about atheists in the first place. You know, you have atheist extremists, you have religious extremists, you have political extremists, you have, you know, sexual identity extremists. You can have extremists in any group. Those things tend to be founded on the belief. Those intolerances spring from belief, not from facts, not from knowledge or evidence or hard, cold reality. And I'm trying to get the idea across that these two things are not the same. And that just because you believe something doesn't mean you know something. You believe it. It's not the same thing as knowing it. That's what I'm talking about. And maybe I'm, you know, not being as clear as I could be. And maybe as I go through this, you know, progress of learning for myself, I'll come up with better words to use for this. But that's the point of what I'm talking about, is I'm trying to get across the idea that the only thing that we should be intolerant of is intolerance. Dolly Jean. I know you have said you achieved the state of clear during the years you were in. I have been curious, though, as to why you never reached or achieved any OT levels. Was it because of a common reason I've heard about, that members in the Sea Org are just so busy with upping their stats and working the majority of their time that they just don't have any extra time to spare for themselves, going up the bridge? Or did you just not have the desire to do those actions? I wanted to do the upper OT levels ever since the day I practically walked into an organization and found out what they were. There's a great deal of mystique and mystery put around the OT levels and the idea of, you know, how powerful you'll be and how it's knowledge you'll never guess what it is and this sort of thing. And so I had a very strong desire to do it, and it actually kept me going through a number of years in Scientology. But unfortunately, the staff, and especially the Sea Organization members, rarely take the time to do Scientology, which is, frankly, you know, from an external view now, one of the most bizarre things about Scientology is that the most inner core members are the ones who do it the least. At the time, the reasons for that are we're too busy, you know, the reasons I had, too busy working, you know, really hard to clear the planet and do all the work that needed to be done, and there was always too much to do and never enough time to do it. And so that didn't afford me a lot of time to do the bridge, to do Scientology. So I never got anywhere near doing those OT levels. I think it's also, I'll just comment here, I think it's quite a telling statement that David Miscavige hasn't done Scientology himself in many, many years, doesn't go in session, doesn't do, you know, doesn't walk the walk, you know? And he doesn't enforce that down the line. If Scientology and getting to OT is the answer to all of the universe's problems, then wouldn't the Sea Organization and the staff of Scientology be the first ones to move up that bridge to total freedom and then bring everybody else with them? You would think, but that is actually the exact opposite is the case. One other thing I'll just comment on this question, just since it's a relevant point and I don't think I'll ever make a whole video about it, is that the day that I walked into a Church of Scientology, I was at the bottom of their bridge to total freedom. I hadn't done any of those steps. I hadn't, you know, my purification rundown and the you know, objectives and then the grades and all that stuff. The day that I left Scientology, after 27 years, I was in the exact same place. My next step was going to be redoing my purif, redoing my objectives, redoing everything I had already done. Buck Young, love your videos. Thank you for sharing your journey with us. I noticed that a number of exes struggle with a duality of some type of recovery or continuum thereof, shame, guilt, anxiety, etc., and arrogance. The former is not unexpected. What I am often surprised by is a seemingly arrogant attitude many exes carry, whether newly out or decades later. Now, certainly this is not unique to this group, but I wonder if this is something that is a residual effect of the church's insistence that Scientologists are a new species and the only ones who can save the world. Will you speak to the duality and possible resolution of this dichotomy? Oh, sure. This is definitely, you know, part of the indoctrination into Scientology. Hubbard's term for what, you know, people are becoming when they're in Scientology is homo novus, rather than homo sapiens, right? Homo sap, as he said. You know, you're trying to create homo novus, new man, in Scientology. And everybody who comes into Scientology quickly learns that they are part of a special elite group that is better than everybody else who's not in Scientology. And merely by the fact that they're there, they have some specialness that drew them into that. Hubbard said the upper tenth of the upper tenth of, you know, of all human beings or something are auditors in Scientology, you know, this sort of thing. And this is something that actually goes on in all cults. It's not just Scientology. And that's actually this us versus them. That's where that develops. And it's very black and white thinking. So in Scientology specifically, you get this homo novus attitude and you get this idea of moving up in spiritual awareness. And so Scientologists actually foster amongst themselves the idea that they're better than everybody else around them. Hubbard also uses language to enforce this, like WOGs. He calls non-Scientologists WOGs, which is a derogatory British term for if I remember right, when the British were down in India, they called the Indians wogs, and it was a derogatory term. I didn't like it when I was in Scientology personally. I never agreed that that was a good thing to be doing. And after Harry Potter came out, this is kind of amusing, after Harry Potter came out, I started calling everybody not in Scientology muggles, because they didn't have the magic. Anyway, so that superiority complex, you know, sort of thing, that arrogance, definitely can continue with people after they come out of Scientology, because it becomes a habit. And as far as resolving it, you know, the ways I know to do it are how you recover. You educate. You get people to realize that what they were part of isn't anything special at all. And also get the language flushed out, because that language, wogs and homo novus and that kind of thing, keeps that mindset in place. And that's one of the reasons why that specialty language exists. And it's one of the reasons why when you get out of a cult, you need to flush that stuff out of your system by not using those words anymore. Come up with other words to use for what you're trying to say, and you'll find the cult thinking patterns kind of flushing out of your system. So, Johnny Boy, my question to you is, when Scientologists are being audited, how far back have you heard a Scientologist remember? The Church of Scientology have a billion-year contract, so I would assume there are some real tales told. Did you ever get audited and have a past life memory? Why is it so hush-hush about these past lives? I noticed that it is a no-no in the Church of Scientology to speak of these, or maybe I am wrong. Glad you enjoyed Toronto, and I hope to attend next year. The reason that people in Scientology don't talk about past lives much openly is because Hubbard said not to. He says, you know, no talking about your case, right? What comes up in your auditing. And he said the reason for that is because it can tend to be very unreal to people who aren't in Scientology or are new to Scientology, or also because it can create conflict. You know, a person could go into their auditing and recall that they were Cleopatra or Napoleon, and they go out and they talk about it, and they might run into another Scientologist who thinks he was Cleopatra or Napoleon, and then they could end up, you know, getting into a pretty awkward situation. So he said, no, you know, that's it. Let's not talk about this anymore, right? So that's kind of a rule in Scientology. And as far as how far back it goes, oh, gee, man, I mean, trillions and trillions of years. I mean, Hubbard was writing issues where he was dating things literally to trillions of trillions of years ago. And it got so ridiculous that I just started saying, look, it's a near infinity of time back, you know, is how far you've lived. And it's of course an infinity of time ahead, because you're an immortal spiritual being. So, you know, the numbers become so outrageously large that they become ridiculous, because you'll find if you try to actually grasp, you know, a billion years, much less a trillion years, the mind just boggles trying to get a grip on how long that is. Things you can't say. Scientologists, both former and current, seem to all be very comfortable with letting the profanities fly freely. Have you noticed the same thing, or am I imagining it? Did it just end up that way for no clear reason? In Keeping Scientology Working Series 1, L. Ron Hubbard wrote that the social veneer makes this universe seem quite mild, but only the tigers survive, and even they have a hard time. And what all that gibberish means is that Hubbard, you know, put across this idea that the manners and politeness and you know, the social veneer, the social niceties that we use with each other, really are, you know, plastic and fake and not really how things are. And that you have to be a tiger to survive, right? And so you get this idea within the Scientology world that they're being honest and open when they're being blunt and profane with their language. And the higher you go in Scientology, in other words, the more into the core group, right? You have public, staff, Sea Org members. And the more you move into the Sea Org realm, the more profane things become. I've seen, you know, teenage Sea Org members swearing like sailors to public, you know, who they were servicing in course rooms and whatnot. And they don't think anything of it. They're just being honest. You know, that's just how it is. You know, they might try to curb it a little bit for manner's sake, but really, you know, you should hear what they talk about, you know, how they talk behind closed doors. So that the reason for that is because they think that social niceties are meaningless, useless, and are something that you do with the outside world in order to put on a good appearance, but really it doesn't mean anything. Elizabeth Lavitt. I have heard people comment that they were afraid of losing their eternity if they left. Other than these comments, I had not heard Scientology mention salvation, eternity, just personal betterment, increased personal power, etc. How does losing one's eternity come in? What specifically makes people think they are saving the world? What do you see in the organization that makes you think you are saving the world? Well, basically, people in Scientology get the idea they're saving the world because that's what they get told all day long. And they start to get the idea that Scientology is the only salvation for mankind. Now, as you move through Scientology and start learning more about it, you start getting the idea that everybody in the world is a suppressed spiritual being who is weighed under by so much trauma and spiritual, you know, horrifying things that have happened to them through these millions and millions of years that they've been around, that they're so screwed up they don't even know how screwed up they are. And it's only Scientology which offers the road out of that, you know, cycle, that endless cycle of life after life after life, where you're just in this sort of slavery and bondage to, you know, bodies and being a body rather than being, you know, an immortal, causative, spiritual being. So that's the sort of mindset that's behind that idea of salvation. And it's the ultimate carrot in Scientology. It's the thing that everybody is trying to achieve. So at the lower levels, you're sold on the idea that the OT levels are what gives that ultimate, you know, spiritual salvation, the idea of personal immortality being restored to you is really the ultimate product that Scientology is selling to people. So at the lower levels, people just believe it. They take it on faith. When they get to the OT levels and they start getting Xenu and the body thetans and all that, they believe that by exercising these body thetans from themselves, that they are freeing spiritual beings, that decayed, practically dead spiritual beings are stuck in this trap, this horrible, you know, awful condition, and that they are personally responsible for, you know, freeing those beings so that they can go off and get a body and do Scientology and go all the way, right? And that's what they're doing. So they believe that they're bringing the salvation of the universe through that auditing. And that's why they do it. You know, they don't do it because Xenu is a really important story to them. Very few Scientologists really care that much about that stuff. It's interesting, or maybe not, and they don't really care about it. And some don't even believe it, but they believe that the meter works and that they are exorcising these spiritual demons. And so they do it because they're trying to save themselves and get out of that cycle of life after life and, you know, bring the rest of the world along with them. David Schlesinger. Chris, you're out now. You're free. I'm sure you have a job, branching out into other topics and subjects, etc. Now that your life has clearly moved on, what do you notice the most comparing your former Sea Org life to now? Your freedom, your daily routine, perhaps friends or financial? Well, it's funny you ask, because it was just last night when I was at a 4th of July party that it really, something very special hit me. I was sitting there with some friends. You know, we were sitting around a table just talking, having a good time. And it suddenly hit me that something was missing. And, you know, it's funny, you don't notice things when they're just disappearing. You know, you notice things when they're present, right? And what I noticed was that the frantic stress level that used to exist in my head all the time was gone. And that felt really, really good. The idea that I wasn't being productive, the idea that I was wasting my time, the idea that engaging in social activities and just hanging out and having fun was a waste of time, and that I could be doing something better with my time. You know, this kind of thing was just hammered into me as a Scientologist and as a Sea Org member, because there's a sort of a frantic, you know, emergency stress level that is always put on you, that you're never doing enough, that you've never done enough. Tom Cruise, you know, in that stupid video, I don't know if you watched that video that he made that was leaked all those years ago, but one of the things he said that was drilled into us was, you know, before my head hits the pillow every night, I have to ask myself, have I done everything I can possibly do with this day to, you know, forward the mission of Scientology? And, you know, when you're living a life where you're doing that to yourself every minute of every hour of every day, day in and day out, you create a kind of insanity. It's the only way I can describe it. And so to realize, you know, that was all gone was a really good feeling. And that's where I'm at now. And all that stuff is sun and gone. So that's been probably the biggest change I've felt, you know, that I noticed in recovering from Scientology. And I think that's pretty cool. And with that, we come to the close of our Q&A episode. This has been a lot of fun. I hope you guys have a great 4th of July weekend, and don't lose your head too much, and keep critical thinking head on. And thank you very much for watching. I'll see you next time.